is Roger Molina on the Bold Rose channel of Creative Disturbance. I'm delighted today to be with Padmasri Pandey, who's been working in the lab this summer. So, Pandey, maybe you can tell us a little bit about yourself.
So I'm an incoming senior in high school. I go to Plano West Senior High, and I am quite interested in the field of chemistry, and I am trying to pursue it in the future with chemical engineering. And I have also been taking art for around 5 to 6 years.
What kind of art?
Well, in the past, I've stuck to traditional 2D art, you know, drawing, graphite, painting. But this past year, I've dabbled in 3D. I've created a lot of sculptures, and my AP concentration was based on paper sculptures.
Very good. So we came up with the name for this podcast of Unconventional Chemistry.
That's right.
Which I must say I kind of like. One of the people that I introduce you to is a chemistry professor here who we just had a conversation with, Jeremiah Gassenschmidt. And I asked you to read a little bit of what he was doing, and you found some really weird stuff.
I did. There was one article I found on his lab website called The Chemistry of Confined Spaces, where he talked about a structure called the metal organic framework, in which they form like a porous solid that can be emptied and refilled without losing the crystallinity that's found in metal organic bonds, which they were researching. And I thought it was quite interesting because essentially these like small atoms and like essentially like nothing create like form together to create 3D frameworks, which I kind of encountered when I was creating my concentration, which revolved around paper sculptures, in which I had to manipulate a substance, a 2D substance, into like a 3D form.
So the very title of the article, which I haven't read, so I have to go read it now, is The Chemistry of Confined Spaces, is already intriguing in itself.
Yeah.
And the idea that you, at the level, at the molecular level, you can engineer these structures by, I guess, adding different kind of metallic organic combinations. So that they preserve their shape, as things enter them or exit them. So that's sort of an interesting thing where, indeed, as you say, with the analogy is in your arts practice, how you went from 2D shapes to 3D shapes. You want to say a bit more about that?
Well, as a 2D artist, paper is sort of my comfort zone, 2D, like drawing two-dimensionally, manipulating shadows and such to create realistic art. But as I went into 3D, it kind of dawned on me that, oh, I have to think in a different mindset. So I thought, why not use what I was comfortable with, which was paper, and manipulate it. So through various folding techniques and, you know, twisting and bending the paper, I created my whole concentration was wrapped around that the creation of paper.
So you know, that's a very good example where many of these ideas on geometry, folding structures, are things which are used in so many different fields, not only chemistry, but as you point out, sculpture. One of the very famous examples of this century, and you're going to help me remember his name, is the guy who invented tensegrity sculptures. You know what I'm talking about?
Not really.
This is really embarrassing, so I'm having an Alzheimer's moment in public here. We'll think of his name in a minute. But he developed these sculptures, which were very stiff, but were basically sticks with ropes in between the sticks. And that idea of being able to build stiff structures from combinations of things of different stiffness has been used tremendously in organic chemistry and other fields. And I'll think of his name in a second. So, but that kind of leads me into a different thing that you'd mentioned to me about some of the work using STMs. What's an STM?
Oh, an STM is a scanning tunneling microscope, and I believe the person who created this project was named Don Eigler. His group at IBM used iron atoms and placed them on a copper surface and used an STM to record their movement, like their magnetic movement and like the shapes and forms they created, and they created images out of these, and like the results were very, very stunning. You would not believe that they were created with such like scientific equipment. They came out to be very abstract yet organic structures, very geometric, but at the same time very, very organic. It was.
So in this case, at a very small scale,
yeah.
The way that matter organizes itself, you end up with these structures that almost look designed.
Yes, they did.
It gets into another topic about how certain things exist at certain scales. Now, in this case, clearly the kind of shapes that you're talking about at the atomic scale, those shape you've seen at human scales,
yeah.
Right? And so in that case, it's clear that there are certain ideas or concepts, or in that case, geometries that are almost scale independent.
Yeah.
On the other hand, there are other things which are not at all scale independent. Mm-hmm. And so the analogy that I just developed is, if you take scales of time, right? And so if you're studying things at the millisecond level, you're not going to use music theory.
Mm-mm.
The ear can't hear things at the millisecond level. There's too much latency in the way that we hear. But once you get into the 10-second or 30 minutes, then you can use music theory. On the other hand, when you get to the 10-year time scale,
yeah.
Music theory is now irrelevant. Yeah. And so I think one of the interesting things is, as one's studying things,
yeah.
What is the scale of the thing? Time, space, size of community, and what are the appropriate methods in the arts or the sciences that one might use at that scale? So I don't know if that resonated a little bit with you.
That did. In terms of art, like, art is a big part of the community, as you may know. In the old times, art was used as a status symbol for the nobility in the Renaissance, to say, I have more money than you, or I can afford to do all of these things. But now, art in the community is very different.
Right, and my reaction to that, I think that's always been the case.
Yes.
And there's a bias factor, which is rich people preserve the things they
yeah.
buy and put them in museums.
Yeah.
Poor people don't get a chance to do that.
Yeah.
And the result is a huge amount of popular culture gets forgotten.
Yeah, it does.
Recently with a PhD student and colleague here, Poe Johnson, we're about to start a new channel on creative disturbance called Dark Culture. And the analogy there is, in astronomy, you've probably heard of the idea of dark matter.
Yeah. Yes,
so every telescope ever invented by human beings cannot see 95% of the universe.
That's
because
true.
It's dark.
Yeah.
It doesn't emit electromagnetic radiation. And so, I always like to say that astronomers have been studying the decoration in the universe, so we're the world's best interior decorators.
Mm-hmm.
But it's the same in culture.
Yeah.
All our cultural telescopes are blind to all kinds of stuff.
That's
and so
true.
A museum is a cultural telescope.
That's
it
true.
Allows you to look in the past of the art.
Mm-hmm.
But museums, in general, don't collect community-based arts, and it's very rare. Why are you interested in that topic?
Well, I'm interested in that because it has to do a lot with chemistry, in the sense that one of the biggest scopes for chemistry and art, the combination of them, is art preservation.
Yeah,
and the studying of like the compounds, the pigments, the organic, inorganic, the materials used to build, can all be studied by chemists in order to preserve pieces of art that become much more valuable now that they have been preserved.
Okay, so we're going to have to wrap this up, but let me just mention that in this building, the Technology and Emerging Communication Building, we also have just down the hallway the Edith O'Donnell Institute for Art History. They just hired a chemistry professor who's working with the local museums on conservation and restoration issues, which is a very difficult area. Especially since now artists are using so many new materials.
Yeah, that's true.
And, you know, it's difficult enough trying to conserve and restore bronze, never mind a lot of the digital devices that are used. So we're going to have to wrap this up a little bit. We've gone at breathneck pace through a number of very different topics. So you're just beginning to apply to university in chemistry or chemical engineering?
Yes.
So where did your interest for that come from?
Well, it came in 10th grade when I was studying chemistry.
Uh-huh.
I took biology the year before that, and I thought that, oh, it's somewhat interesting. I like the chemical aspects of it, like, you know, the chemicals that make up proteins and the helix structures and such. But then when I took chemistry, I really enjoyed the numbers because some people just enjoy the comfort of empirical evidence versus uncertainty. But right. In art and in interdisciplinary studies, you get to explore both the rationality of facts versus the unpredictability of art and.
Okay, as you know, I'm not in favor of false dichotomies, but so the world is more complicated than rational and unrational.
Yeah.
But I'll just give you a personal anecdote. I know we're over time, but Hal is waving at me over here. But when I was in high school, for whatever set of reasons, I got interested in amateur rocketry.
Mm-hmm.
And I had a really good chemistry professor called Radin, John Radin. And he allowed us to use, in fact, I shouldn't say this because it was probably illegal for he allowed us to use a lot of the materials from the chemistry lab to play doing amateur rocketry experiments, which we did without adequate supervision probably. And one of the things we learned how to do was to make rocket fuel by melting sugar and putting perchlorate in it, which is the oxidizer.
Yeah.
And the advantage is you heat up the sugar and then you mix in the perchlorate and then you can pour it into the rocket body and then it cools and then you can light it and you have
and
an amazing. The problem, of course, is heating up the sugar and putting in the perchlorate, if you go above a certain temperature, the thing
explodes.
It detonates. And one time, actually, the igniter was zinc and sulfur, which is also a very good combination. And one of my friends, we were 17 or something, we were working, you know, mixing our rocket fuels for our tests, and the thing just went off on the lab bench.
Mm-hmm.
And fortunately, all he got was singed eyebrows, but it could have been a lot worse. Mm-hmm. Anyway, so we all learnt basic lesson on safety and chemical compounds.
Yeah, no matter how much you.
Yeah, at the same time, you know, one of the pleasures of chemistry is that you get to mix things together and see what happens. and so experiment, you know, chemistry by its very nature is trying to look at different combinations of things and how they'll behave. Okay. Gee, what else should we, how should we conclude this? Unconventional chemistry, the chemistry of confined spaces. I think that's a great title for our podcast.
Yeah, I think so too.
Thank you.
Thank you.